with the Agile Revolution. This is Craig. We're at the YAO 2016 conference in Brisbane. It's great to be sitting here with Emily Weber. How are you doing, Emily?
Good. Thanks for having me.
So people, if they know the name, go, where do I know that from? They may know you from such publications as the Communities of Practice book, mm-hmm. which I'm sure we'll get to in just a moment, as well as my little favourite ebook of the moment, The Agile Onion, mm-hmm. that I think I've spoken about on the podcast before. So, but awesome to have you here in Australia. Is this your first time out here?
It is, yeah.
Yes, well, welcome.
Thanks, and it's been nice to experience some sunshine because it's quite cold at home.
So home is usually London?
It is, yeah. Mm.
So the question I always ask people when I first start into these conversations, how did you get into this whole Agile caper?
Well, and like any good Agile coach, I went to art college for 6 years. Mm-hmm. and I think somewhere along the journey, I've always been a person that likes to make things happen. So I went through a bit of a strange route. I spent some time at an arts consultancy, doing things like did some tour management, so getting on tour buses, taking bands around the country, getting involved with projects around kind of bursaries for young musicians. And at some point I decided that actually I wanted to move more into the tech area. Actually when I was at art college, I spent a lot of time on computers. I had a NetArt space in 1999. I won't tell you the name because you might find it. and kind of found myself back in kind of digital world, but really frustrated with the way that things were done. I worked for a place that had something like 17 account managers and 4 developers, that kind of thing.
Mm. Because that's a perfect ratio.
Well, yeah, exactly. You've got a lot of people selling stuff. And then just dumping it on developers going, well, you know how to build it, right? I've solved this impossible thing over here.
Mm. And by this afternoon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. and then ended up finding myself really frustrated with that and joining an organisation where there were more my people, mm-hmm. Teams of people working on things together, which is very different.
It's interesting, actually, as I go around conferences, not the first person to say that, particularly at Agile conferences, where people say, I found my people.
Yeah.
And I think it takes a special kind of person, I think, to try and sort with all the team issues that happen, mm-hmm. Particularly in larger organisations. So when did your Agile journey actually begin?
Probably then. When was that? I can't think now. Quite a few years ago, about 6 years ago, mm-hmm. maybe a little bit more. When I found my people, and I eventually kind of wound my way up to working with Government Digital Service, which was a really fascinating place.
Were they already on their Agile journey then? Because they are like the poster child.
Yeah.
Rightly or wrong. They're the first to start breaking some of those barriers, I think, and you see the work that then. The United States government has mm-hmm. done with their, I forget what they call their digital agency now. Mm-hmm. The same thing has happened here in Australia. Were they already on that journey when you joined?
They were. So it was always Agile, but kind of by design or probably not by design. They started up as a very small bunch of people that were looking to do things a little bit different, almost a bit like a Skunk Works over the corner somewhere over there, with doing things small enough so that government didn't really notice, because what tended to happen is in government that big money and big projects means important. So if you can do things small and under the radar and show that things can be done, it's you can kind of get away with it. So it's a good way of getting away with it. They did get away with it. They did really well. They showed people what they were up to, and other people got very excited about it. Different ministers got excited about it. I joined them probably about just as gov.uk launched, which is the main way of UK citizens interacting with government services. So it was a little bit, actually the day I joined, it was a bit like a ghost ship. So this thing had launched. Everybody was just like exhausted.
Yeah, we'll be in bed seeing through it.
Yeah, exactly. So they've been going for about 2 years, and that's when they were really starting to shift away from just focusing on fixing publishing in government and focusing on also focusing on helping other departments transform.
Yeah, because one of the things from talking to government departments, both locally as well as federally in this country, and in fact I hear the same things in the US, is government's a big ship to move, and it's that balance, because we talk about in the commercial sector that we want to go fast, but government's built to be stable. Yeah. So it's this whole...
Was stable, but then they may change every 4 years.
Well, that's true, yeah.
So what's tended to happen, it's probably similar here with the DTA, is if you can get small pockets of excited people together, and often a mix of people from outside of government and people from inside of government, then actually you can make some really fantastic things happen.
Mm. Well, and just for those... what are some things that, with your Agile, your people hat on, and I'll come back to the community practice in a moment, but what are some of the things that actually you look back on your time there and go, that was pretty awesome?
Actually, working at GDS is a pretty amazing place when you've got some really passionate people that come from lots of different places, both the public sector and from the private sector. It's just the passion that comes with that that's really amazing. And also, I think one of the things that which happens in any transformation is there are loads of people that already exist within organisations that are really passionate about what they do, but haven't necessarily had the right haven't been quite powered in the right way, or haven't seen a different way. And actually, in engaging them and getting those people to help with that transformation is kind of a really sustainable and a really great way of helping the organisation.
So I mean, I lived in communities of practice, and you are talking here at Yale conference on that topic. I would hope most people listening to this podcast or watching this video that we're recording here know what that term means. What's your message? What are you trying to tell us about and encourage us to do more of?
So communities of practice are really about about building knowledge, about giving people support networks they need in order to have the confidence to do their jobs well, and really making that practice as good and better always, as good as it can be, and continue to be better. It's a little bit more of about sustaining organisations rather than the quick wins. Let's just build some stuff. It's the bit, I think, where an organisation turns from creating some stuff quickly to how do we keep this thing going in the long term and really build something solid. Mm-hmm. So it sits there, yeah.
So does it, because most people are aware of the Spotify model, so Henrik Nyberg, in fact, just created two problems. He didn't create the model, nor does he want to call a model.
All right, exactly.
Let me refract.
The way Spotify were doing things for a bit.
There you go. Yeah. But people are aware, I guess, of that whole process of their tribes and their squads.
Yeah.
And they have this concept of a community of practice in there. Is that somewhat like what you're talking
about?
Yeah,
similar. They have two things there, actually. They have chapters and guilds, which are both kind of similar. And let me try and get this right. One way round is a line management structure. And the other thing they have is communities of interest. And those communities of practice and communities of interest differ slightly, but they can coexist. Practice tends to be about the job role that somebody does. And interest might be a thing that interests them that might cut across job roles.
So yes, I'm a business analyst, but I'm really interested in microservices.
Yeah. Exactly.
Not sure why those two things would go together.
There's no reason why they wouldn't.
That's exactly right. So communities of practice have been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. That's not a new term. And I don't know when they started becoming popular in businesses, but I'd have to think it's a child of the 80s or at least the 90s. What makes communities of practice different in your world?
So, yes, they have been around probably since the 90s. And they've always sat quite a lot within knowledge management, which is how do we maintain knowledge within an organisation.
Emily's giving a talk at 2 or 12 o'clock. Everyone be there.
And that tends to kind of also go alongside tools and people building platforms for people to speak within organisations. and can often focus on tools, but not always focus on tools. The way that I talk about it focuses a bit more on the people rather than the tools, but also being where we used to be with organisations, and I've been in an organisation like this myself, is that you'd sit with the people that did the same role as you, so you have a functional area and you learn from the people around you because they're there and you're speaking to them all the time. Where that's changed more recently, hopefully for most people, is that people now sit in multidisciplinary teams. So you may have somebody, business analyst over here, that's the only business analyst in their team, and they don't kind of, you can end up with this bit of team silo where they don't necessarily talk to a business analyst that's over in another bit of the organisation. So it makes sense that you find a way to bring those people back together so that they are sharing knowledge, learning from each other, crafting their practice. That's where communities of practice really sits with agile organisations.
Because we have made it worse for ourselves, I guess, in that respect, mm-hmm. In that for all the benefits that having a cross-functional self-organising team bring, it's the things that you lose out. And I guess this does pick up that the issue that people could argue about why you wouldn't set teams up in that way.
Yeah. But they should set teams up in that way. Just find other ways. And it fits with the scaling conversation, and I won't go too far down the scaling conversation.
No, let's talk about the safe next time.
Because it is about maintaining at least qualities and standards of what you do across the way that you do things within organisations. But it also sits, and I have conversations with people that are in quite small organisations, and they might be the only person in that organisation that does a thing, and they kind of need support as well, and they tend to look for people in other organisations that do similar things, and that's why meetups are so successful or conferences are so successful, because people are looking to share with other people.
Yeah, because I think it's interesting you get onto that point. We often think of the community of practice being something that's in an organisation, and if you're a large financial institution, insurance company, or those sort of things, that does make sense. But if you're in a small company, yes, absolutely, meetups and conferences are good, but even being able to find a way to talk to people in other organisations. And I don't know about you, but I think that's the thing that was always attracted me to this Agile community, because it broke down those barriers of company secrets to a certain extent.
Yeah.
I don't think 10 years ago we'd be here talking about the GDS, because we wouldn't be allowed to.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, that's interesting. But there are always some boundaries around that.
We don't talk about how we or the problems we're trying to solve, but we can certainly, the process is something that everyone can learn from.
Yeah.
Why reinvent the wheel if somebody has already tacked that process before? Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm not going to tell you how I store my customers in my database or those type of things. But I think the process is one of those things that we can all learn from. And it's interesting in a conference like this where people are talking about failures and those kind of things as well, which is very interesting.
Yeah, and it's that thing where you can learn from other people's mistakes. You still need to make your own mistakes as well, but it gives you a bit of a leg up that you don't necessarily need to make all of them.
So there's something you see in communities of practice that people feel either A, that they have to have a compelling story to tell, or B, they have to have that 70 slide pack in order to do that. Is that a failure mode that people fall into when they try and set up communities of practice?
Not really, because actually most communities of practice that I come across are fairly organic, and they've grown from people just getting together. What tends to happen is that when people need, so we will need support, we will need other people around us, this is quite important. When people are doing something, particularly if it's a new role, they tend to look for people that are doing something similar, which is why meetups are so popular. People gravitate towards other people so they can try and answer some of the questions that they've got in their heads. That is what I tend to see, is that kind of happens, and then they don't necessarily go anywhere else. A few people will talk, but they won't include other people. Might just be because they don't really know who they are. So I'm often, one of the things that I often do is kind of help kickstart them a bit, give them a bit of direction, taking some of the things that I've learned and saying, hey, here's some stuff that you can do. This is how you can move to the next level. Sometimes that's that just people get together and moan a lot, and moaning's good, but actually you don't want to do that all the time because that just brings everyone down. Mm. And there's other things that you can do when you get together.
You said one thing you just said in that sentence, something you did talk about in the talk, is being able to sort of give people a kickstart. Is some leadership support essential for this, or is it just a passionate person that that says, you know what, I'm going to find out how to run an internal discussion group?
So I think that's probably the passionate person is probably better than just appointing someone that's a leader. If you appoint a leader that's a passionate person, that's probably the right person to appoint. Not everyone's particularly geared up for doing this or cares. Mm. So those people that do are the people that should run with it, really.
Can you see that in the community? You run meetups and I run meetups and we're suckers for punishment.
Everyone goes, great job, let me know when I can come again.
But there's a certain kind of person that does that, and then I think you might talk about this in a talk where you kind of got the workers and the lurkers, and they're the people that do sit around the outside and will turn up every now and again, and then you've got that, but you need that core for it to actually operate.
Yeah, and those are the people that are passionate about making it happen.
Mm.
And even if they are, and I often have conversations about the word leader in a community, because there's often the question, like, who is that? What does that mean? And particularly in organisations that have a little bit more of a hierarchical structure, it's often thought, well, that needs to be somebody that's a higher grade or a manager. But it's more of a servant leader role, which fits quite nicely with Agile, of course, that it's a facilitator rather than somebody that stands at the front and tells people what to do.
Mm, absolutely. We obviously want people to buy the book or go watch the video and talk, but if you had to give someone some advice about how to get their community practice operating, is there one piece of advice you could give them?
Well, of course, there's my maturity model, which you can download for free. Having an idea of who the community is for and why it exists is a good thing to do. So like any good, you know, team has a vision and understands what they're doing, great thing to do. Getting people together, also often there are people in an organisation that do the same thing that don't know each other exists, so actually just kind of getting them together and starting some stuff there. Lots of other things. One thing that's really important is getting a regular time in the diary so that people can meet. Mm. If they don't interact with each other on a regular basis, you can't really form a community. Mm. You need to talk to each other. That can be harder when the community is distributed.
Yeah.
You end up resorting to things like teleconferences and things that make it difficult, but at least ways for people to interact.
That's actually a really good question. Is there a secret to getting good community practice when people are distributed, or is it much better to have people at their sites who are together? Like if you're a one man person, let's just say in China, working on a team, rather than trying to connect to someone in Australia or the UK, would you be better trying to find another organisation near you and connect with them?
Probably, yes. I mean, face to face is always best. Because it helps build trust quicker. I am working with communities at the moment that are distributed, and the tact that we're taking there is that they meet when they can. So that might be, you know, once every couple of months, once every 3 months for some of them, depending on how far they are. And then that's backed up with things like tools where they can talk to each other, like Slack or online forum type tools, and video chats can be good. What I also, for them, what I say is, if they can't all be in the same place at the same time, you can have one person from one location visit while you're having your call or your video chat, and then kind of swap people around. Mm-hmm. What it helps to do is start to get, again, break down trust. People start to recognise what you look like, so when they're talking to you, it's not just random person on the end of the phone.
Mm.
So anything to build trust is good, as well as social events if they are meeting up.
That's the most important point, is to not make it just about information, but to make it about people. So you know, having food or actually having a Christmas drinks or something is an important thing of any practice, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Is there a risk that people run into in organisations where you may have too many of these things? ones. Because I don't know what the lifespan of these things. You see them sort of spring up and they spring down, and you know, people get really enthused for a little while. But I've also seen the one where people then go and just set up, you know, 47 of these mm-hmm. things across the organisation, and that's not good either. Is there a balance that you've seen?
Good question. I think it depends on what they are. If they're communities of interest and people belong to multiple ones of them, you might find that they spend all their time just being involved in the communities, and that's not very good because they probably need to do some work as well. If it's role based and it's about their role, then I don't see a problem with setting up as many as is needed for any particular role.
So it's like everything's just that, the value and the effectiveness coming out of the end.
Yeah, and actually sometimes it's a challenge with developers, I think, actually. And I've seen this in a few places where community practice will be all the developers, and that will be loads of people. And some of them might be front-end developers, some of them might be one language, another language, and actually that kind of becomes a bit of a mess, and they end up dividing off a bit into more specific groups, if that's relevant.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. So I want to shift gears a little bit. I mentioned the Agile Onion earlier. So that's actually how I first came to know about you, because if it's free, it's me. So I saw this book come out, and then that inspired me to go and actually find your other works. For those who haven't, or if I've just made a complete muck up of all that on a previous podcast, can you explain to everybody what the whole Agile Onion thing is about?
So I'm going to say there's a really important word in there, which is team. So it's the Agile Team Onion, not the other Agile Onion that's out there. So the Agile Team Onion is all about communication, actually. So I've worked in organisations where... And most organisations will be like this. You'll have an agile development team, and it'll be small enough, you know, somewhere between 5 and 9 people, probably, maybe a few extras. And they work quite closely together all day, every day. And they're building stuff, and that's fine. But the moment they try and put anything out there, they come across security or procurement or marketing or another piece of the organisation that doesn't know what they're doing, and essentially blocks them, not through any fault of their own, just because they didn't even know that this thing was going on or that they were even part of it. So the Agile Team Onion is all about thinking about the Agile team as not just the people in the middle, but how you communicate with the rest of the organisation, and the fact that you're all trying to do things together. So how do you, pragmatically do that together without destroying the smallness of the team that need to communicate with each other? So I came up with this map concept, this map model, the onion model, which was about the core team that sit in the middle. They said they sit together all day, every day, they talk every day, that kind of thing. And then trying to identify the people that they need to interact with on a regular basis. So those are the collaborators. The final layer outside of that is supporters. So supporters are a little bit more like stakeholders, but the collaborators need to be treated like they are a member of the team. And what I've done with teams to use this is to help them map out who sits in that collaborator ring. So who do they need to engage with on a regular basis? How often do they need to engage with them? So it might be a couple of days a week, which again builds trust and helps them understand what it is that the team are doing, so they don't end up kind of being this assurance process at the end that says, no, you can't do that, you can't go live, you can't do anything. Working out if they know they exist, how they know how they work, what impact they'll have if they don't collaborate, what value they'll get from the team, and then going, mapping this group out, and then going to speak to them and actually having that sitting down and having a face-to-face conversation with them, and then asking them for their time.
Yeah.
So it's all about, it's again, to use the words, it's kind of like scaling, but doing it in a way that, you know, you're working with people, and being respectful of people's time both ways.
So the way the whole reason I actually came across it was, to me, the way I explain it, you can either shoot me down in flames or go, I'll steal that, is it's like, to me, it's like a modern-day racy. I want something to replace that because there's value in it. But as soon as you get into that, it starts to get this whole sign off type mentality. What I liked about that is I can have those conversations of people, but in a different terminology and in a visual way that that actually allows people to speak to each other.
Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah, but I don't like to use the word stakeholder when I'm using that and start to talk about team because you're in it together. Bringing people in, but modern day racing.
When people sort of ask me about it, they go, well, actually, how about you use this? So there's always a project manager holding on to something, go, but I need this, go, well, here's the replacement. For it. The way I used to explain it, and it's another thing that I haven't really used it for, but I always used to talk about the team, and particularly when you're trying to make an agile adoption, is you just have to draw a bubble around your team to begin with, and you sometimes just have to do all the things that are on the outside. But then what you want to do is just want to start bringing in the deployment people, the procurement people, and sort of start to extend your bubble around the outside of it.
Yeah.
But I always had a hard time explaining that. So that's why I also like this, because that whole idea of collaboration is really key.
Yeah, and there is a really important point here that often some of the organisations that I work with, the agile teams kind of do work in a bubble, and the rest of the organisation aren't becoming agile. There isn't any particular desire for them to become agile, and you need people to talk to each other in a way that isn't, you don't understand how we work, which is kind of the default. People are just people. You need them to talk to each other.
Mm. So you're now you've moved on from the GDS, and so now you are agile coaching in other organisations. What are some of the biggest challenges that you're sort of facing in general now as an agile coach sort of out in the wild?
Well, so many things. I think it's. I mean, you must find this as well. Sometimes you go into organisations and they're really at the beginning of their journey. So it's helping people understand the principles of what agile and lean as well.
Just to be clear, it's all under the umbrella.
Right? Umbrella.
I'm starting a movement. We like to join me. I want to get rid of the word agile altogether. I want to call it raccoon.
Raccoon. Why is that raccoon?
It's just a word.
Okay, we call it raccoon. There
you go. Jeff Patton actually said to me on a previous podcast that they're the things that scour through his bins. I mean, I just thought it was a cute animal from living in this part of the world. But
that's actually, I was going to say, one of the problems is the word agile. It means a lot of things to a lot of people that frightens them.
Mm.
So a great deal of pragmatism is needed. And I often find that going back to principles and helping people, which, the agile principles, for example, and the lean principles, they're really common sense. So how can you help people move a step closer to making things better without trying to shove it down their throats?
Yeah.
Which some people do now. So it's helping people. So some of the biggest challenges, helping people break out of some of their preconceptions, or some of the, just helping, I guess, have the motivation or the empowerment actually that they can change things, particularly if they've been somewhere a long time.
What about agile communities of practice then? Because I see these pop up when people are doing a transformation. What's your thought on those? Because I'm in two minds. I'm of the belief that agile is the vehicle, not the destination.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad that people are at least trying to work their way through the myriad of the minefield in organisations. Any thoughts on?
Yeah, not a bad thing if it's a way for people to feel supported, and having that support gives you that kind of safe to fail environment, because you've got other people around you that are saying that's sensible. So not a bad thing at all. It's probably not the end state, because if you're transforming an organisation to agile, then that'll end up having everybody in it. So there's probably a point that you want to break that down. But that's when it stops becoming useful, I guess.
And I find that the things they're talking about, they're trying to work their way through deployment and testing and things like that. And I guess there's a point where they then become their own community of practice, an agile testing group or an agile deployment group, or and hopefully just a testing group and a deployment group as they move along the journey as well.
Yeah.
So any kinds of things you're seeing now that are exciting you as an agile coach that that have had your attention recently, or think you've read about or heard about?
Good question. I tend to get really, I read a lot that's books that are more about people, actually, and that is the thing that probably gets me excited. So seeing people get excited about what they're doing is probably where I focus a lot. Just think, what am I reading at the moment? I'm reading Messy by Tim Hartford, which is all about how we need to be able to control our working spaces and change them as we want to. Otherwise, that kind of inhibits our creativity.
As an individual? Because if you think things like mob programming, for example, that Woody is talking about at this conference, or even it's pair programming, that implies almost a cleanliness aspect to it, to a certain extent, that, you know, this device will always be the same. And
yeah, no, more that the team have control over it. It's quite interesting.
So it's such your own space and those type of things.
Yeah, so that you can put things up as you want to.
Stuff in some kind of keyboard. I don't know about you, the amount of organisations where you can't stick something on the wall.
I know, or your hot desk so you never have the same space, or clean desk policies and that kind of thing. It's the book's interesting because he talks about the fact that that's actually the opposite of what you should be doing.
There you go. I think we could all make a bit out of doing all the opposites books.
Yeah.
I think we could just walk around and find them. That might be our next book idea or something. Anyway, great to talk to you. I've talked to you for hours. But if people want to know more about you and what you do, where can they find out more information?
So I have a multitude of websites, of course. My blog is at emilyweber.co.uk. I also have a site at eweber.co.uk, which has links to all of my other projects, including my meetups and some other things.
And some interesting stuff you were telling me about as well. Some of your stuff is completely outside of the Agile field as well, right? In relation to the, was it the bus stops or the photography?
Oh, stuff? Yes. Oh, yeah. I have a blog called London Shopfronts.
Shopfronts, that's it. Bus stops.
Photos of shopfronts in London.
Bus stop shop fronts. Completely not related.
Oh, similar. Some mundane.
I have a funny feeling when I look at that website, the one I looked at shop front, I think had a bus stop near it.
Right.
And now that's my image of the website. There you go. But yeah, that's really interesting stuff to go look at as well.
One of my early forays into public speaking was at a conference called Boring, where I was talking about London shop fronts.
Boring. Was the conference anything but?
Yeah, it was about mundane things.
Excellent. Well, there you go. And obviously the two books are the Agile Teen Onion. I apologize, I screwed that up. That's a free download.
That is a free download. You'll find it on one of my websites. It might actually be on my company website, which is tacitlondon.com.
And that's certainly where you can find the Communities of Practice book.
Yeah, so that's Building Successful Communities of Practice, and that's on Amazon.
Excellent. Well, it's been great having you out here for the conference and great spending some time with us. Now, one last thing I'd have to ask you. When we do finish the podcast here, we like to finish with a little Viva La Revolution.
Okay.
So would you join me in one of those as we sign off?
Sure.
So thanks, everybody, for listening. Until next time, Viva La Revolution.